baseball fans, and welcome to a podcast to be named later. I am your host, Chris Mitchell, and we've got an exciting show for you today. Vince Lara from Baseball America is going to be joining me. We're talking minor league prospects, and these podcasts are posted over at minorleagueball.com. So it seems only the right thing to finally, and this is, we've talked about prospects a little bit in some of our other podcasts, the wraparound. The Major League Baseball wraparound we've been doing, where we've gone through most of the AL East. I actually just did the podcast for the Washington Nationals the other day. That'll post in a few days. We've been talking about prospects that can impact those teams, but they've been just one part of a larger podcast in analyzing all the different teams. Today, we're talking just prospects. Nothing else, no teams. We're not talking about major leaguers or second-year players or anything like that. Today is nothing but prospects. And if you're going to talk about prospects, there's no better place to go than Baseball America, and there's no better person to have on than Vince Lara. So we're going to be doing that today. And we're going to be doing a lot. We're going to talk about the top lists. We're going to be talking about the top players. We're going to be going through some of the lists that Baseball America has on their handbook, which I just received today. I'm excited to get it in the mail with the additional supplement because I ordered directly through Baseball America, which I highly recommend everybody do. So I got my handbook, ripped it open, tore it to shreds like Christmas morning, and now I'm going to look through some of the top 50 prospect lists and go through that with Vince today. And we'll also look at MLB Pipeline, and we'll look at their list because every list is a little bit different. A lot of the same names, obviously, but some of them rank them in a little bit of a different place, and we'll talk about that. We'll also put a little bit of a fantasy spin on it as well, because not only does Vince write about prospects, he does the team rundowns, the team top 30 rankings and things like that, along with their analysis and their scouting reports. But he's also a fantasy sports guy, and so we're going to ask him not just about the baseball players from a baseball perspective, because we want to know about that. And, for example, a guy like a J.P. Crawford, I don't think he's going to be a great fantasy player, but he's ranked in the top five or six in most prospect lists. So I want to talk about that as well. I want to talk a little bit about prospects and how a prospect is different when you're looking at him from a fantasy perspective as opposed to just a baseball perspective. And defense matters to fantasy, but it matters a lot more without it. And we'll get into some of those details. And I'll ask Vince, how is it different? How do you evaluate a prospect differently? How do you rank them differently? Are there certain skills you're looking at? Because a lot of fantasy leagues, you're looking at 5x5 or 6x6 categories. So obviously you like home runs, you like stolen bases, you'd like to see a decent batting average. But when we analyze prospects now, you get into WAR and we get into UZR rating and all these different advanced metrics and things like that. What categories, which of those things can help you? Which of them matter? There have been some people that I've talked to in the past who look at things like OPS or look at any WAR ranking they can find or something that resembles WAR, as it's a lot more difficult to find that in the minor leagues. And they look at it and say, okay, well, this guy has 3 home runs, 9 stolen bases, and he hits about .265. And yet because he has something advanced so-and-so, you love this guy. And I've seen some people that do it that way. And it's interesting, and it's probably relevant, but I find it a little bit difficult to look at those things. But we'll talk to Vince a little bit about that and see what he knows when it comes to that. I am your host, Chris Mitchell, in case you did not know. This is a podcast to be named later. We have a Facebook group if you'd like to join in there and suggest topics for the show. Again, it is a podcast to be named later. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I can direct you to wherever you need to go and make things easier for you. If you want to follow us on Blog Talk, where our program is located. On Twitter, I'm at CJMitch73. If you do want to go directly to Blog Talk, it's blogtalkradio.com/BoscoNation. And if you click on there, you can be alerted to when the programs are going to be airing live. We air them live. You can listen live. I also post them in the Facebook page. I post them on Twitter. And then we also post them on minorleagueball.com. So those are all the different places you can find us. But let's get right to Vince Lara today, talking prospects with him. Vince, thanks a lot for coming on. Love having you on here. Love talking prospects. Like talking fantasy with you as well. How's everything going on with you here in February 3rd of the baseball season, which to me is a 12-month-a-year thing?
Yeah, yes, it is. Hey, Chris. Yeah, doing really well. Good to talk to you.
The handbook came out this week. MLB Pipeline came out with their top 100 prospects list. They did the show on MLB Network, which is sitting in my DVR for constant reflection. let's start right at the top. And again, I do want to get into some of the rankings that the Baseball America guys did, but let's just go right off the MLB Pipeline at first. And they've got Corey Seager at number one. And I think he's going to be, I'm preparing a top 30 list of my own for rotoexperts.com as we speak. And I think I'm going to probably put Corey Seager number one as well. But I'm curious. You got Seager at 1, Buxton at 2, Giolito at 3, Urias at 4, J.P. Crawford at 5, Orlando Arcia at 6, Yoan Moncada at 7, Dansby Swanson, who I definitely want to get into with that trade from Arizona, number 8, Joey Gallo at 9, an intriguing guy that I'd like to get into as well, and then Tyler Glasnow. That's the top 10, and we'll go into a little bit more detail on some of the other ones. But as far as the top 10 goes there, what are your general thoughts on your list? What's your opinion of where these guys would be? And putting Seager ahead of Buxton, do you think that's justifiable? Do you agree with it? Or do you think it's justifiable, but you disagree with it?
Our list, I don't know that I want to comment so much on MLB Pipeline's list, but ours is going to come out on February 12th. We're doing a show on MLB Network as well at 9 p.m. Eastern, just to give us plug there. We're going to do our top 50 on that, and our top 100 will also drop that day. So we'll do 50 on MLB Network, 1 to 50, and earlier in the day we'll do 51 to 100. But just in general, I think that I would probably agree with that ranking, and the reason I would is, as talented as Buxton is, Seager made it to the majors and succeeded a lot quicker than we expected, in fact. And Buxton made it to the majors. He struggled a bit. His raw tools are still there. But in general, I think that that's something that you'll see. We have something very similar on in our list.
Great. And that's why I'm actually going to go over some of the lists from the handbook, because I don't have a top 100 from Baseball America. So I didn't have that as reference material, or I would have gladly used that instead. And actually, Jim Callis does the work over this. It was kind of conflicting. He did great work with you guys over at Baseball America, and now he does it over at MLB Pipeline. So it's hard to say your list is better than theirs, because he essentially comes from your blood. So, I can definitely understand. And just to repeat, I don't have access to yours. We didn't talk about this ahead of time, so I don't know.
Sure.
Let me ask you about Buxton. I agree with everything you said about Seager. To me, the upside for Seager is that batting average, the way his hit tool is so good that he could bat anywhere from 2 to 5th. And for fantasy purposes, that matters. If a guy's batting 3rd, 4th, or 5th, the RBIs will probably be there along with the run scored, whereas if you've got a guy who doesn't hit with that kind of hit tool, maybe he doesn't. That's where I look at Seager as, because he's not going to probably run a lot, but a hit tool as good as his along with the power at a middle infield position, I can definitely see why he would be ranked number 1. And that hit tool, to me, enhances his value, because you like to see upside. If you're going to have someone at number 1, you want them to be really good. You want to know they're going to make the majors, which, of course, we assume they will, and, of course, Seager did. But you also like to see that there's room for actual improvement as well. Seager doesn't look like he has as much as a Buxton, but Buxton hasn't really performed for a variety of reasons. What are your thoughts on his? Because you hear comparisons to Mike Trout, which I think is a little bit too lofty. I compare him, and I think it's a really good comp, is Carlos Gomez. He's not as raw as Gomez was. I mean, when Gomez was with the Mets and even with the Twins, he was a horrible baseball player and just a fantastic athlete. But he eventually became a really good baseball player. I think Buxton's ahead of him as far as when he was at the bottom. But you look at the issues and maybe some of the issues he's had and some of the inconsistencies. To me, Carlos Gomez is a pretty good comp, but we keep hearing Trout. What are your thoughts on Buxton and his development so far? It's been a kind of a tricky one.
Yeah, I don't think it's a fair comparison for either one of those guys. I mean, you can't compare anyone to Trout, obviously. And Gomez's game is even now a lot more rough than Byron Buxton's is. And the reason I say that is I think Buxton's a better defender in terms of technical skill as a defender. I think that Gomez has incredible ability to get the ball. He gets a good jump, but his routes are still not as clean as you'd like to see. And it's kind of like in football with route running in football, you'll see a guy take a certain tack to the football, and it's a lot cleaner than other guys. The other guy might get more catches because he's got better hands. But in terms of the route running, I think Buxton has it over Gomez. And in terms of their hit ability, Gomez has more power. I think that'll be the case. I don't think Buxton will ever hit as many as 25 or 26 homers as Gomez has, but I think there's less swing and miss. There's certainly less swing and miss to Buxton's game, or there will be once he becomes the player we think he'll become. Whereas Gomez kind of has the will sell out for power on occasion, will really swing hard, really has a lot of swing and miss, especially with the breaking pitch and stuff away. And I think that once Buxton gets to the level we think he'll get, he'll make more contact. He'll have a better inside-out swing. He probably won't hit 20, 25 homers, as I said, but I do think the hit tool will be better. And I do, it's really hard to say. I think he'll be a better player than Gomez, but I think if you were to overlay them, I think you'd see a lot of differences in their game. And I think that would be in the benefit of Buxton in that case. And yeah. in regard to Seager, I think of Seager as less of a 3-4-5 hitter. I do see him as a 2 hitter. I do see him as a 6 or 7 hitter. I don't quite think he'll have the power to hit in the middle of the lineup.
Yeah, and that's I think I probably agree with both of those things. But I'm looking at it as maybe if he reaches a ceiling. I agree. I don't see Seager hit a guy who hits 20 home runs probably shouldn't be hitting 3rd, 4th, or 5th. I agree with that. But if he gets to 25 or maybe even gets near 30, maybe he could. That's sort of like, again, the upside. I wouldn't project him to be that. I don't think, just like you said, that he fits perfectly as a number 3, 4, or 5. But if he can hit 325, I mean, if he can become essentially Joey Votto with a little bit less home runs, and nobody's going to have an on base like Joey Votto. But if he can be sort of like that, you could see how Seager could become a three, if not an ideal three. But again, and he'd have to hit 320, 330 to do that, and to expect anyone to do that it is asking a lot. But that's the upside that I see of Seager, that if he's going to get there, if you want to be optimistic, with Buxton, I think it's the 30 home runs. I don't think most people think he will get there, but you hear sometimes about people who think he could get to 30.
I don't see it, Chris, in either case. I don't think Seager's anywhere on the – I mean, Joey Votto is an elite offensive player. I mean, a guy who will get to 1,000 OPS, will get to 900. He just walks so much, and he impacts the ball on such a regular basis. Even now, even as he's, sort of begun to decline phase – And that's a really high barometer for a middle infielder. Seager might end up at third base. That's true. He'd be expected to do more as a corner infielder. But I don't think that he's anywhere near Votto's offensive ability.
No, and I'm not trying to say that I think he'll get there. I'm just trying to come up with a comp as a way of kind of giving a player example of an upside. And to me, that's all. I can't think of a guy who hits 320, 330. There's just not a lot of them who do that. And so if Seager is going to bat 3rd, 4th, or 5th, I think he has to get to that. And, I mean, if you're going to try to comp someone for Seager at the ceiling, hitting 320, 330, that could justify him batting 3rd, 4th, or 5th, I guess who's the name that you would pick out? I'm not saying he's going to be Votto, but I don't know who else to pick. I mean, how many guys hit 320 or 330 and could possibly bat 3rd with a lack of power? Because, again, 20 home runs is a little bit light at 3, 4, or 5. So I can't think of another guy to think of without – I don't think he's Votto.
I think offensively I'd comp him more to Jeter. I think he's more of a, 15 to 17 home run guy. I think he's I think he'll hit 2nd. Maybe if he reaches his ceiling, he might hit 3rd, but I just don't see a big power guy. I think, he'll have a solid average. He'll hit 280 to 300, and he'll hit 18. Jeter hit 24 in his best year. That's certainly possible for Seager, I think, in his prime. But I do not see a 30 home run year for him. But that's okay. I mean, because if he's playing a premium defensive position, he still has tons of value, fantasy and for and in real life, if you will.
Yeah, and being a Red Sox fan, I have a hard time bringing up Jeter whenever possible. As much as I respect him as a player, it just hurts me to throw that name out there. But I think I agree with you. And I think to confirm that, I traded for him in one of my fantasy leagues a couple of years ago, and I took the risk that he would be a shortstop because at third base, I don't think he has a lot of fantasy value. I mean, anyone who hits 300 has value. But like you said, I think 15 is probably a safe projection, and 15 home runs at third base is not a great fantasy player. So from that perspective, I think I agree with you. I think I agree with what you're saying. To finish up with Buxton before we talk about Giolito and Urias and some of these other guys, does it bother you that – because being a Red Sox guy, I always bring up Red Sox examples. J- Jacoby Ellsbury was an injury-prone player, but it wasn't like he had pulled hamstrings or something that was a reoccurring injury. He crashed into Adrian Beltre, and he got hit on the head by like Derek Jeter on a slide to second, and so it was these weird contact injuries. And Byron Buxton has kind of been the same way, but it's hurt his development. He hasn't been able to play 150 games consecutively or things like that. Do you think this is going to hurt him ultimately reaching his ceiling, or is it just going to slow down his progression? Because we want everybody to be here yesterday.
Sure. I think. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to say, is this going to just slow him down, or could it possibly lower his ceiling because he didn't have the development time that he probably most guys would have had if not for these weird bang-bang kind of football injuries?
Yeah, it's so hard to say. I think the safe answer, and I know it's a layup, is maybe. Because, you know, there are guys, we were very high on Jabba Chamberlain, for example. And you could say that his development was ruined by how the Yankees yanked him back and forth. But you know what? Maybe he would have never gotten to that place just because he lacked the work habits that were necessary to get to that place. So it doesn't seem to be the case in Buxton's case that his work ethic, according to everybody that we've spoken to, is excellent, and he's a good kid. But, you know, here's a good linear comp for Buxton. Aaron Hicks was a high draft pick of the Twins, and he was, in many cases, very much like Buxton. He was a supreme defender who could hit, could really run, and the Twins rushed him a little bit, and he started to show some signs last year. He hit really well against left-handers. You know, they traded him to the Yankees because they had a chance to get a good backup at catcher, where they were really looking for depth, and John Ryan Murphy. And so, but, you know, now Hicks is 25, 26, and he's sort of a platoon guy. He might just be a right-handed hitter against lefties, but he can still really play the outfield. So you could argue, was his development really hurt by the Twins rushing him, or was it that he would never get to that point and isn't as talented as Buxton? It's really hard to say. You know, I mean, some guys get it. Some guys get to that point no matter what a team does to hurt their development track, you know. And some guys don't, and it has nothing to do with the development track. So, you know, sometimes it's as nebulous as, well, the guy couldn't perform with a third deck in a stadium. He did great with a two-deck, 10,000-seat stadium. But once you add that third deck and those lights and the seats and the fans and the background, you know, things change. It's really an unquantifiable sixth tool for some players, Chris, that they can't get over the hump for whatever reason. And maybe, you know, maybe Buxton, you know, won't get to that ceiling, but he'll be a tremendous defender who eventually becomes a pretty good hitter. You know, it's really, those last steps are really hard to make for some players, and really hard to figure out for people watching the game.
And let me ask you about that, because I was going to wrap up on Seager, but let me throw him in here one last time. In your estimation, would Seager be a plus defender at third base? We know he's not a plus defender at shortstop. Some people don't believe he should be a shortstop at all. He's going to be, at least for the foreseeable future, which is great for fantasy people. But if or when he moves to third, will he be a plus defender there, or just league average or slightly above?
Yeah, I think it's always safe to say league average, and I think the same thing at short. I mean, I think he's got all the skills and actions to play the position pretty well. But, you know, he's not another guy who you talked about earlier, Orlando Arcia, who's clearly a supreme defender, or a guy like Raul Mondesi, the shortstop coming up in the Royals chain, where managers will say to you, you know, minor league managers will say, I don't care if he hits 240, he's a player for me because he gets the ball, and he's a guy who can defend, and it's all about run prevention. So, you know, Seager's not in that class. I mean, he's not Wilmer Flores, but he's not, you know, he's not Andrelton Simmons either. So he's probably in the mid pack of defenders. He's sure-handed, got a good enough arm to play third base, clearly, if that's where he ends up. But you know, I think in the long run, I think he probably will move to third, just because it preserves his legs a little bit as an offensive player. And probably because the Dodgers, before you know it, will have a guy who can play short better than he can. So,
yeah, because I look at it, and I think people are happy with what they saw from Seager in the majors, and he hasn't disappointed. I mean, he's flown through the minors. And so you look at it and you say, okay, Seager has succeeded everywhere he's gone, whereas Buxton's development's been a little bit bumpy. But you look at Buxton's ceiling, which is much higher than Seager's, I think, and then you look at Buxton's floor with him being at least a plus defender who can steal bases. So his floor is probably higher than Seager, too. So you look at, and it's almost like Buxton's number two and Seager's number one, because Seager has probably exceeded expectations while Buxton has had this kind of bumpy ride, and the expectations were so high to begin with. I mean, throwing out comps like being in the Harper Machado Trout class, I mean, that kind of expectation has been thrown at him for quite some time. So he almost had to disappoint. It's almost like Buxton probably should still be number one, but it's almost the media game that has flip-flopped him right now. And I can't blame them. I'm probably going to do it. I haven't fully decided, but I'm probably going to have Seager 1, too. But I'm kind of talking myself into thinking that maybe Buxton should be number one again.
Yeah, I can see that. I think it's fair to say that Buxton's offensive ceiling, offensive floor is lower than Corey's, but that Buxton's overall floor is probably higher, just because being able to play center field and play it as well as he can just automatically makes him more desirable to his team and to other teams that might say, you know, hey, let's get him on the cheap while he's hurt. And I mean, that's not the case right now. The Twins wouldn't trade him on the cheap, but if he's, you know, if he's still, you know, a 240, you know, sub 700 OPS guy, at some point, you know, the Twins will have to say, you know, how long do we wait? I mean, they cut bait on Aaron Hicks, who was the number 10 pick overall this year. And so, you know, that sort of timeline for him is still 2 years away, I guess. But it's a very intriguing case, 1-2 on those guys.
And now let's go over to Lucas Giolito. And I think this is sort of a media analysis kind of case, too, because in fantasy sports, and I do think fantasy sports impacts the mindset of everybody, even people who are writing for Major League Baseball, even people who are, I still think the fantasy analysis gets in your head. You know, home runs and stolen bases are just ingrained in my head. So is batting average. Mm-hmm. They're ingrained in my head as a way of evaluating a guy. And batting average doesn't matter to sabermetrics people at all. And even fantasy people are downgrading it as value, and very few people are even hitting for it anymore. And yet it's still ingrained in my head. I look at those three categories first, and then I go from there. And so offensive guys always seem to be ranked higher. But you look at Giolito. You look at his ceiling. You look at how he profiled. I mean, could you draw up a more perfect ace? If you're gonna literally create Frankenstein's monster in a prospect and say this is an ace of the future, isn't Giolito that? And yet he's ranked number three. It seems like with how he so perfectly fits what you would want to create as a monster, it seems like he should be number one. But it just doesn't seem like we put pitchers at the top. If there's any bats that can overtake him, it seems like they always get the nod.
Yeah, I think, and you know, in Giolito's case, there's also the Tommy John surgery, too, that sort of clouds things. Because, you know, we've seen pitchers have two, and even in some cases, extreme cases, three Tommy John surgeries. So, I mean, the Nationals have also been really patient with his development, you know, probably slowed him more than people thought at this point. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's much easier for the industry to evaluate hitting prospects than pitching prospects, because there's just so much more evidence. There's just so much more to go on. But that's why you'll see pitchers not rate as highly as hitters, unless there's a slam dunk pitching prospect like a guy like Kershaw or something like that.
Yeah, I'm a pitching guy, so I actually think the one thing with pitching is it they do seem to always get hurt. And a guy who can go out there and throw 200 innings 7 or 8 years in a row, it just doesn't seem like that's even possible, never mind likely. And so
doesn't
I can
exist.
See why.
Yeah. I mean, even Kershaw's been super dependable and durable, but what was it, 2 years ago, I believe, he missed the start of the season, or maybe it was last year, I'm getting confused about that, but and pitched, you know, 194 innings, which is still good, but it's so rare to find a guy who can pitch 200 innings a year for 7 or 8 years anymore. Sabathia did it and then really cratered quick. You know, that kind of durability is really tough to find.
And if you're going to have an ace like Verlander once was or like Kershaw is now, not only do you want 215 or 220 in the regular season, but you want another 30 or 40 in the playoffs. And before you know it, it's 280 or 290 innings if you count spring training. And you say, wow, we threw that many innings last year. What is he going to do the coming year? So it's almost like you sacrifice 1 year for the next. Yeah, it is. It's definitely a concern. To me, pitchers are easier to analyze because you know if a guy throws 98, you know if his breaking ball is filthy. And for the most part, with sample size, you know if the command is there. So for me, I like it, but it does seem like the injury aspect of it throws in a wrinkle or a wrench that is impossible to predict, but you should probably assume is going to happen. I can definitely understand that, which brings me to Julio Urias. I think purely on stuff, he hasn't pitched a lot for a variety of reasons. He's 6'2", size is a problem. To me, in fantasy terms, when I look at it, I've been telling people to hold on to Urias because the buzz isn't quite enough. I mean, he's getting a lot of buzz, don't get me wrong. But it's not like he is the hottest guy out there that everybody wants to own. I don't think he's at that level yet. So my recommendation is in a nuanced one, which is hold on to him until that buzz reaches the pinnacle, then trade him because at 6'2", he's a little bit slight. I'm afraid that he is going to struggle to throw 200 innings 4 or 5 years in a row. So bring in a mint of a return on a trade, but wait for the buzz to reach that level. Am I overdoing it? Should I not be as concerned about the fact that he's 6'2", or is that something that we should legitimately? I mean, Scott Kazmir turned his career around, but I mean, small guys they concern. I'm concerned about Sonny Gray, for example, this season.
Sure. Yeah, and I mean, there's some validity to that, Chris, for sure. I mean, I think we had a talk yesterday at BaseballAmerica.com. We were discussing the editors were all talking about, you know, how we evaluate pitchers, because it's difficult. We looked at our own internal, you know, metrics of pitchers and how we've rated them in the past and, you know, our successes and failures in who we pick. And a lot of times the walk rate is the thing to really look at, and sometimes the physicality of a pitcher. So you mentioned the size. And it's really easy for us to default to the big guy, to a guy who's 6'5", 240 like Giolito, who we think can carry, you know, can carry the weight. And I think you have a valid point in talking about Urias not being the biggest guy. I mean, he's 6'2", probably, we think. He's slight. I don't think the eye issue is going to be a long-term issue. You know, he had cancer. I shouldn't say cancer. He had a tumor removed from his eye. It was largely more about the aesthetics than any issue with his health. So he missed some time with that last year. But the Dodgers have, again, been very careful with his development track. He pitched very briefly in AAA last year. He didn't do well. And so I think they'll be slow to bring him along. No need to rush him. They have plenty of inventory in their starting rotation. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's legitimate, Chris, to tap the brakes a little bit on a guy who's not big because of how we've seen small pitchers, develop in the past.
And do you think he's in the major leagues as a starter in any meaningful number of innings this year, or do you think they continue to slowly bring him along? Because you hear Jim Callis talk a lot about how he's so good he could be a reliever right now, but that the Dodgers are pumping. That's one of the excuses they used about having him have that surgery on the eye, was that they didn't think it was a problem, but this was a way for them to limit his innings and slow him down a little bit. So,
yeah, I mean, I think in any meaningful number of innings, no, I don't think so, not in 2016. Again, they have so much depth and inventory in their rotation, the major league level, and these Cuban guys they've signed who are advanced in terms of age, and Kenta Maeda, and a returning Brandon McCarthy from Tommy John surgery. So there's enough there. And I think they'd even bring up Jose De Leon before they brought up Urias, because De Leon is older and he's more, you know, he's more physical, I should say. I don't know that he's more durable, obviously. And also, I happened to do the Texas League last year in terms of our prospects. And I talked to a couple of managers who really felt like De Leon would ultimately be the better pitcher of the two, because he's got more of an arsenal. I mean, his changeup is really good. He's better conditioned now than when he came out of Southern. So you might, if anybody, you might see De Leon quicker than you would see Urias. And again, Urias is still really young. So I would be very surprised if he saw, you know, I would be surprised if his prospect eligibility is not intact for 2017. I'll put it that way.
So theoretically, if Giolito throws 70 to 100 innings with the Nationals this year, which is possible, I don't know if it is or not, but we could actually see Urias possibly at the top of this list next year, maybe?
Maybe. I mean, you know, I think Yoan Moncada is more likely to be at the top of the list. You're talking just in terms of pitchers or overall?
Overall, yeah.
Yeah, I think if anybody jumps up to number one, it'd probably be Moncada, just because everyone who's seen him is so flabbergasted in how quickly he's come in the year he's been in the States, how his development from, you know, when he got here and looked a little rusty after that long layoff to what he was by the end of the season. I think if anybody is going to be at the top, it'll be him next year. And I think, you know, then you slot in whoever you want to slot in behind that. But that's what I think.
Yeah, I wonder with the Red Sox what they're going to do. Where's Moncada going to play? That's my
problem.
You mean
positionally?
Yeah, I mean, he's listed at second base, right? But, I mean,
right.
They've got Pedroia there forever. I'm wondering where he's going to play. He probably won't be in the majors this year, I'm assuming. But
no way.
If he's ready in 2017, does that mean mm-hmm. Pedroia is put out to pasture? Or where does the Red Sox find a place for him?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, they have tons of infield depth. Obviously, Bogaerts is going to play short. And, you know, there's no need to move him. He's terrific and he's young. I think, but that's something the Red Sox are not thinking about for 2017. I think Moncada's earliest is 2018 into the majors. And even then, I mean, that might be rushing it again. He's really young. We're talking about a guy who's going to go into his second year in pro ball in the States. I guess he's a second baseman. Yeah, I guess. I mean, the Red Sox have such deep outfield. Such a deep outfield as well, it's not like you can say, well, he'll play left field. Maybe he will. It's hard to say, but I think they'll find his bat someplace in there for sure.
Yeah, as people like to say, and it's actually a phrase that I hate, it's a good problem to have. They've got Devers at third,
totally.
Bogaerts at short, and they've got all that outfield. It's in that case, I guess it is a good problem to have. But we'll see. And that leads to my next question, which is fantasy versus reality. And I think this next group in 5 through 10, or 5 through 8 at least, fit that description pretty well. J.P. Crawford, Orlando Arcia, Yoan Moncada, we just talked about, and Dansby Swanson. Everyone's up in arms, and everyone's just pairing into the Diamondback. They're shuffling out prospects that are highly rated like they're nothing.
And I
want to look at that. When you look at Crawford, Arcia, and Swanson, and Moncada, I guess, is a second baseman, but we just talked about him,
mm-hmm.
is Crawford a good fantasy prospect versus a good Major League Baseball prospect, or is he both? I don't see it there, and I'm not sure about Arcia. He's come a little bit quick. I'm not as comfortable and fully knowledgeable with Arcia or Arcia as maybe others. I'm curious, of these middle infielders, where, to me, that's where the biggest disparity is. Because a lot of them, they hit well for a shortstop, but they don't hit well in general. I mean, a lot of these middle infielders, if they hit 15 homers, that's fantastic. If he hit 15 home runs in the outfield, the guy would be a bench guy for fantasy owners. So of these middle infielders at the top 10 or 15 guys on the overall list, which of them are Major League Baseball prospects that deserve that high, but maybe aren't necessarily fantasy prospects and wouldn't be ranked that high?
Yeah, it's a good question, Chris, because, I think if you're talking in terms of how quickly they'll get to the majors, it's a different conversation. But if you're just talking about which of these guys would you rate more highly as a fantasy guy, none of them are going to hit a lot of home runs. I think that the guy with the most power of those is Swanson. And, you know, I was told his ceiling is probably 10 to 15 home runs. Swanson's a sum of his parts guy rather than a real toolsy guy. He's a smart guy, tremendous makeup. I remember speaking to his Hillsborough Hops manager last year, who's the former Yankee, Shelley Duncan. And Shelley loved him. He said that he came in not with the attitude of, hey, I'm the number one pick. he came in, he rooted on his teammates, he was on the top step, he was the guy who was, you know, clapping the loudest, greeting players when they came back. And this is a guy who had just gotten done with his college career and was the number one overall pick and got, you know, a $6 million bonus and, you know, didn't have to – I mean, he got hit in the face with a pitch in extended spring before he came down to play for Hillsborough, and he didn't – you know, he could have gone home. You know, he could have said, hey, guys, I need to heal this up, and, you know, the season's almost done anyway. And he went and played, and he played really well, got a big hit in the Northwest League Championship Series. But that's my long way of saying I think he's probably the safest bet of those guys, but I think Crawford is the guy who has the highest ceiling of those three. You know, supremely talented defender, real high offensive capability. Arcia is a tremendous defender. He might be the best pure defender of those three guys. But, you know, his bat is a little bit in question. We were debating it this week, Arcia, in terms of, you know, is he more impact bat than Jose Peraza and Ozzie Albies? Is he, you know, I mean, he showed some real ability to impact the ball last year in AAA and AA and AAA with the Brewers. He was hitting for extra base power, showed some over-the-fence power, you know, can get on base, has a real good hit tool, you know, smart approach. But, you know, you just never know how he's going to match up against premium velocity. And that's the only way you find that out is in the majors where everybody throws 96. You know, is the bat going to get knocked out of his hands? And that's the problem we have with Peraza is the guy ever going to hit for any extra base power? Because he doesn't walk. And so if he doesn't walk, his on-base percentage is completely tied to batting average, which is so volatile. You know, like if Peraza doesn't find the hole and he hits 280 and he gets on base 32% of the time, he's a way less valuable player. So, I mean, that's a long way of saying I think that if I were putting any money on it, I'd put it on Swanson just because I love his makeup a lot, but that Crawford is the highest ceiling of those three guys.
And everybody was shelling the Diamondbacks when they made that trade, and so I immediately sure. came to their defense. I always like to claim, I always like to argue the other side of things, regardless mm-hmm. of whether I believe it or not, because everybody needs a case to be made for them, and very few seem to be making one for the Diamondbacks at that time. And
right.
with the fantasy mindset that I kind of come with, I try to bring the Major League Baseball elements to it, but my initial reaction is always fantasy based, and for me, Dansby Swanson may not average 15 homers. Like you said, he may get to 15, but is he guaranteed
right.
15 for 8 years in a row? Maybe not. That's not a guarantee.
No.
Is he going to steal 25 bases every single season? No.
No.
He may not even steal 15 a year, right? So
right.
you look at him and say, wow, you just traded the 1-1, but he's a 15-homer, 15-steal, 280 guy. That's a great shortstop. You move him into the outfield, and he's a fourth outfielder. And so that's why – you got to make an adjustment for position, but I like to try to compare players purely on what they perform at statistically. And Swanson is not—he's not Bryce Harper 1-1. He's a really good all-around player with a lot of intangibles. I mean, really, the strength of his Major League Baseball case and probably the strongest argument against the Diamondbacks are the intangibles. And to make that the primary argument against the Diamondbacks trying to get a number two starter, if they think that Shelby Miller is a number two, I think maybe they do. I don't think the Diamondbacks made as horrible a choice. Everyone said 1-1, they traded the 1-1. Oh my goodness, they traded the 1-1. This was was one of the weaker 1-1s we've seen in a very long time, and the ceiling isn't all that high there. He's kind of like Dustin Pedroia, only because he's 1-1, he's hyped, whereas Dustin Pedroia was further down in the draft, and so no one really expected anything. That's kind of how I saw it.
I think, Chris, man, I think they'd be thrilled if he was Dustin Pedroia. I would be stunned if he has that kind of offensive ability. I mean, Dustin Pedroia is a tremendous – he was a tremendous offensive player. And I don't see Swanson having that kind of impact. You're right about the 1-1 argument. We had a scouting director when we were at the National High School Invitational last year in Cary, North Carolina. We were talking about the draft at that point, and the scouting director said, in any other year, Swanson would be – the 15th pick, maybe the 20th pick. So, you know, clearly there was a, you know, a paucity of talent at the top of that draft last year. No Bryce Harpers, no Trouts, no one in that ilk who was at the top of the draft. That said, I think the argument was how much the Diamondbacks gave up in that trade. I mean, they put Aaron Blair in that trade too, and I think a lot of people would have said that the Braves probably would have made that trade for Swanson alone because of the Georgia connection that Swanson has. I mean, he's from Marietta. So when the Braves opened their park in 2017, they fully expect to have Swanson as their shortstop with their new stadium in Cobb County. So that had there was a large impact of that trade right there.
Yeah, I like Blair. Obviously, he hasn't emerged. He hasn't fully realized his potential, but I do think he's a little bit an undervalued guy. I do. I like Blair. I have high hope for him. Again, he's not a Giolito by any means, but he's a guy I think is pretty good. I think he's kind of an overlooked guy. That Diamondbacks, right. they had a lot of really good prospects. Aces, I mean, Archie Bradley never came to fruition as of yet anyway.
Right.
But they had a lot of pretty good arms, and a few of them just got overlooked.
Yeah, I mean, they still have Braden Shipley. I mean, they have some other guys in there who they've held on to. They're an interesting case, Arizona, but they clearly don't value prospects, or at least their prospects, the way other teams did. I mean, they threw Ison Diaz into the trade for Chase Anderson, where they got Gene Segura from the Brewers. And Diaz, you know, Diaz was the seventh prospect in their organization and a guy who, you know, tore up the Pioneer League for whatever that's worth. But, you know, went in there and, you know, posted a 9-something OPS and, you know, was really hitting the ball with authority. And they said, well, you know what, we'll throw him in this trade to get Gene Segura, a guy who, you know, has really declined offensively the past couple of years, and a guy who the Brewers said, yeah, no problem, we've got Arcia on the come, and we've got Jonathan VR here right now as a stopgap. So the Diamondbacks have a very different understanding of their prospect system. You know, to them, it's a place where they trade from. You know, they want to do a quick rebuild, obviously, and so they didn't value Swanson the way other teams did or do, and they didn't value Ison Diaz the same way.
And I guess there's two ways to look at it. If you want to look on the positive side, you just say they value their players differently and give them the benefit of the doubt and say they know them better than we do. That's giving them credit. I guess you could look at it on the negative side. And in like every fantasy league, there's one owner that just isn't a very good negotiator and just can't negotiate the best deal. Maybe they're just not good poker players. Maybe they're or maybe the Braves are that good. I mean, who knows? But then again, it was the Brewers, so maybe everyone else is really good, and in Stewart and La Russa just aren't very good poker players. Maybe that's how it goes.
I try to give them the benefit of the doubt. You know, Chris, I mean, these guys are in the game, so they know a lot. They know a lot more than I do, obviously, and they just value players differently. They have a different set of skills they're looking for, perhaps. When Tony La Russa says, we see something in Gene Segura, you know, we recognize there may be other elements that contributed to his play, you know, I have to trust that Tony La Russa knows what he's doing, so.
Yeah. And just to wrap up the middle infielders, J.P. Crawford, can he get to 15 home runs and 20 steals a year? Because I don't see him as a really good fantasy player. He's a great athlete. Can he get to 15 homers and 20, 25 steals? Because to me, that makes a difference. You think he can get there?
Definitely. I think he's one of the guys who we really, really love as a prospect. You know, his defense is so good that during the Futures game, they moved Arcia to second base to play Crawford at short. And Crawford's, you know, his offense, like I said, of those three guys, it has the highest ceiling to me, I think. He has excellent hit tool. I think the power could be there. I don't know how much, to be honest, but, you know, the power potential is there for sure. I think you'll see him have an offensive impact on the lines of Jimmy Rollins, I think. And if you remember, Rollins was a tremendous offensive player at the height of his. I mean, you know, he was a guy who could get you double-digit doubles, triples, and homers and, you know, 40 steals. I know we love Crawford for sure.
Yeah, and Rollins, and I guess benefiting from that Philadelphia park, which is closer to a little league park than a major league park. It's ridiculous there.
Right.
That's my question. And again, I'm conservative. I have a little bit of a tougher time. I'm always overly conservative when it comes to offensive players. I always doubt that the power's coming. I'm just, you know, it's just harder to see. There's more trust involved, and I'm just not a trusting person. I am always more conservative in projecting offensive players, and even more so for middle infielders. Because again, you just don't see a lot of 20, 25, 30 home run guys. Like, you just don't see. I didn't think Correa would hit as many home runs as he did. I never projected Francisco Lindor to hit consistently 15 home runs, and he hit 12 last year in a partial season. So I could end up being way wrong with him as well. To me, it's difficult to project offense, especially on middle infielders, and so that's what makes Crawford interesting to me.
Right. I think you're totally right with Lindor. I think people questioned whether he could impact the ball as much and as frequently as he did. He was tremendous. Seen a home run off of Dellin Betances, you know, who was, I'm sure, was throwing 97 at the time, and he turned it around. And in terms of Correa, though, you know, I did the Astros and for the 2015 book, and Correa, a scout told me at the time, comped to Albert Pujols for power. He said that Correa had such amazing opposite field power that he didn't put a 30 home run season past him. And now he looks like he could hit 40 one year. I mean, he's got that kind of punch, especially in that stadium.
It's interesting about Correa because he was supposed to be a settle because he was going to took under slot money. It allowed them to sign. What was it? Josh Hader was the other guy they wanted to add. So they want, or I think it was. Was it Hader where they want Correa and Hader, or they wanted Hader?
No, it wasn't Hader because Hader was the who they got from the Orioles in a trade. It was I think it was Lance McCullers. I forget who else. Preston Tucker. There were a couple of guys in that draft.
All right, because they wanted to save money on number one so they could overpay slot for the number two pick. And I think you're right. I think it was McCullers, now that you say that.
Yeah.
And maybe that was a correct, and maybe Correa just emerged. But Buxton seemed to be what should have been the automatic number one best player in that draft. And now, obviously, Correa, people forget that they settled for Correa because he was under slot.
Right.
Or at least that was the story. Maybe the Astros didn't think that, and they probably didn't. They've done some great job in drafting, but
the Astros also drafted Appel over Bryant. So I mean, you know, every team has its successes and its misses, and that's just the way it goes. But they definitely called 2012 right, I think. And like you said, a lot of teams criticized them for it. So. But, yeah, I think that was – they wanted to sign McCullers, and they have a bunch of – I mean, that 2012 draft, which was Jeff Lunau's first, is Correa, McCullers, Brett Phillips, who they traded, Preston Tucker, who was with the big league team. You know, you look at those, you know, first seven picks. These are guys – Rio Ruiz, who they traded, but, you know, these are Brady Rogers, Nolan Fontana – guys who are still making contributions some way in their organization. So they've done a good job of drafting.
No doubt about that. That's putting it politely. We always like you said with the Diamondbacks, trying to give them the benefit of the doubt. When it comes to the Astros, especially that draft, you're trying not to be too boisterous. You almost sound like you're working for them. They did such a good job. You really can't say high enough how good of a job that they did do. I mean, phenomenal. You see why the Cardinals are trying to hack their system.
Exactly. I mean, their draft last year was ridiculous. Bregman, Tucker, Cameron, Eshelman, who they traded, Riley Farrell, who scouts were raving about. You know, they couldn't believe they got Riley Farrell that late. You know, I mean, Michael Freeman, who might be in the majors this year. You know, I mean, they do a good job. I mean, I tend to gush a little with the Astros because I like their front office and, you know, they do a good job. But, some teams just know what they're doing.
Yeah, Luna definitely seems like he knows what he's doing over there. Let's do a quick synopsis of the, let's say, the top 30 or 40 or 50 or whatever it may be. Who are the guys that you maybe think are a little bit overhyped or a little bit overranked? And who are some of these guys that maybe are a little bit underappreciated, or I hate to throw out the tag sleeper, but maybe guys who aren't maybe ranked as high as maybe they should do, or maybe this is a year where they break out and fly up the board?
You're talking about like the not fantasy prospects, Chris, just overall?
Either way, guys. You can go baseball related, or if you want to throw a fantasy spin in there, by all means, do analysis in any way, shape, or form you want.
Yeah, I think for me, when I look at like the top 100, or let's just look at the top 50, I think, and guys who may or may not be on that list who might be a little underrated. To me, a guy like Brett Phillips is still underrated. I think that what happened to him last year is when the power sort of disappeared a bit when he moved up in class, kind of scared people off, rated him a little bit lower. But he's such a good defender, tremendous makeup guy, a guy with a real shot in 2017 to be in Milwaukee in center field in a very, very young outfield. So he might be a bit underrated to me. Christian Arroyo is a guy who, you know, I handled the Giants midseason update in 2015. And at that point, I remember talking to the Giants and wondering what was up with Arroyo because he wasn't hitting much and he got sent back down to short season ball, you know, a year after being a first-round pick. And he was really struggling, couldn't play short. And you see him last year just have a tremendous season. And people think, okay, this guy can play the middle infield. Maybe he's not a shortstop long term, but he's a guy who's back on the radar. You know, he'll be in our top 100 for sure. He'll be someplace in there, but he might be a little lower rated than I would have pushed. And a guy like Aaron Judge, I know he's very highly rated on some boards, but there is a little prospect backlash with him. Maybe it's prospect fatigue, which happens from time to time. You hear enough about a guy and you start nitpicking him. You start looking for warts. And I think what people are doing is they're seeing this really big strike zone with him and saying, is he going to be able to control it enough to hit home runs? 6'7" is really hard to comp because he's not Giancarlo Stanton, who has a similar stature but has a different game. You know, it's really hard to pitch Stanton outside because he can reach everything, and you can't bust him inside because he's just his wrists are too strong. You know, Judge doesn't have that kind of game. But he's a good outfielder, which gets overlooked, and I still think he'll hit home runs, and I still think he'll have an impact. But I noticed that he's lower on a lot of lists than I would have expected. So those are three guys I think could be made a case for being higher up in lists, you know, someplace.
And I think I'm one of the culprits when it comes to Judge. A guy who's that big, you expect to be able to hit 40 homers, and he seems more of a guy who will hit maybe for average or make more contact than maybe he should. He'll take a base hit rather than swinging for the fences all the time. Those are things that probably should be praised for. But like you said, because he's 6'7", we expect him to be Giancarlo Stanton, and that's just not the guy he is. I think I'm victim of that. I think I'm one of those perpetrators. I think I'm committing the crime there.
I think a lot of people are, though, and I'm not saying that he, you know, I don't think he'll ever hit 280 or higher. I think he's probably going to be a 250 guy because he does have such a big strike zone. But he will walk, which is, you know, makes him valuable. He will hit home runs. You know, he probably will hit 20 in that range. And I think he's a really good defender with a good arm, and that there's a lot to be said for that, for a right fielder, you know, a right field prototype guy.
And when you're evaluating prospects, we've kind of been bouncing between fantasy and baseball related.
Sure.
Are there certain tools or certain metrics or certain things you look at and say, this is the one that maybe tells me whether this is a good major league prospect or whether he's a good fantasy prospect? Is there anything that kind of separates those two in an easy way, or how do you go about it? Because again, you write about both, you know both, you must think both. How do you go about separating? Again, J.P. Crawford, I was a guy who thought maybe the power wouldn't be there. Now that I talk to you, maybe I have to change my mind on that. But how do you go about doing it? How do you differentiate between a really good baseball player and a really good fantasy baseball player?
Yeah, they're really clearly delineated topics. J.J. Cooper at BA, at Baseball America, did a great article last year where he looked at, like, fantasy guys for the end of the season. But he just looked at – he looked very narrowly at some of the things that those guys could do from a fantasy from a fantasy standpoint. And it was guys like Rico Noel, super fast, you know, 80 guy on a 20-80 scale for speed. and looked at, well, if you're looking for speed for your team, this is the guy. You know, Noel can't hit a lick. You know, just signed a minor league contract with, I think, the Dodgers. So he's not going to be in the majors. But so my point is, when you're looking at a fantasy guy, you try to pick out the things that a guy can help you with in specific categories. Like, all right, this guy's not going to hit much for power, but if your league values on base and average, here's your guy. Or Terrence Gore, guy, tremendous speed, top of the scale speed. If he gets 400 at bats, he's going to steal 40 bases, guys. So that's the conversation you have in fantasy a lot of the times, is you look at the narrow, you narrow cast, if you will, for specific things that a guy can do for you from that standpoint. Because a lot of the questions that we get is, hey, I need saves for my team. Who do you recommend? Or I need steals, or I need power. Whereas if you're looking to evaluate prospects, you look at specific metrics, like for pitching, we were talking yesterday about this. Walks per nine are a huge indicator of whether a guy can be a starting major league pitcher or a reliever. So let's say we arbitrarily place that at four walks per nine as the cutoff point. Anything above that, this guy's probably a relief pitcher. Anything below that, he might be a major leaguer. It might be a major league starter, depending on physicality, velocity, size. You know, I mean, there are a number of other factors. But you kind of look at, you try to find one thing that is a separator, because so many guys throw hard these days. So many guys are big, but a guy like Sean Newcomb is a perfect example of this. Overwhelming, overpowering stuff. Braves went out and got him, gave up their best, maybe Freddie Freeman is their best player, but let's say their second best player in Simmons, because they're so enamored with the fact that this guy is big, physical, throws hard, moving quickly, got to AAA last year. But, you know, he also walked. In AAA, I think he walked six batters per nine, maybe even seven. Even at AA when he was dominating, he walked four per nine. So, you know, you start to wonder, can he get that under control, or is Sean Newcomb just going to be a tremendous knockout reliever a la Andrew Miller eventually? So, I mean, that's, you know, those are the kind of things you look at, like what's going to be the thing that puts this guy over the top. And I think for pitchers, it's probably walk rate. It's one of those things we're, like, messing around with, how we decide that. And for hitters, for me, it's the walk-to-strikeout rate. I mean, I look at that so closely, because if a guy – if you're seeing – let's take a random example of a guy who has, you know, 600 at-bats, walks 23 times, and strikes out 117 times. And so you recognize, okay, his plate discipline's not great. He's going to depend heavily on batting average, which is very volatile year to year. You can hit the ball as hard as you want in 1 year, and your BABIP is, you know, 360. Do the same thing the next year, and it's 290. And then you're talking about a 230 average versus a 290 average, and a 360 on base versus a 320 on base. Unless you're going to hit for a ton of power, you've got so little value at that point. So that's what I look at. I like to look at strikeout percentage versus walk percentage, and strikeouts versus walks in general, because I really think plate discipline is very overlooked in our power-starved game. You know, people will easily say, I'll take the strikeouts for the home runs, but they overlook the fact that there are other ways to get on base.
And it looks like some prospects are changing a little bit. I mean, we look in the major leagues now, and Chris Davis is probably the perfect example. We don't care if he strikes out 230 times. He's going to hit 40 right. homers. And a lot of guys do that. A lot of guys only hit 25 homers, but they still strike out 190 times. But you are right. seeing some prospects making a little bit more contact. I mean, Mookie Betts, Corey Seager, they flew right. through the minors, and they hit everything. So maybe we're seeing a few more guys doing that.
But that's why they flew through the minors, though, Chris, is because they made that constant contact, you know, because they put together that really elusive part of the game. So, yeah, I mean, I think the thing to note, too, with that kind of thing is it depends on the team, right? So the Orioles were willing to go to that level with Chris Davis, even though they know he strikes out a ton of times. The Mets were willing to go to the level with Yonis Cespedes because they really needed a power-hitting right-handed hitter, even though they know he's not going to walk a lot. I mean, his on-base percentage is below average. It's 320 in his best year. And so they're willing to live with that. A lot of teams aren't. He didn't survive long with your Red Sox because of that kind of thing. You know, the Red Sox got him. They were really excited about him. They traded John Lester for him. But ultimately they thought, this guy doesn't fit in with what we're trying to do here. He doesn't get – on base is not his thing. And, they traded him after a couple of months. So it's team-centric a lot of times.
And then they went out and they got Rick Porcello, who and gave him a gigantic contract. I mean, when a scoreboard client signs before before he hits free agency, the GM didn't do a good job.
But, right. I mean,
we're stuck with
sure.
We're stuck with him for quite some time now. Yeah.
Yes, you are.
Let me ask you about this. And I do a top 10 fantasy prospects list for rotoexperts.com every year per organization. Mm-hmm. So I do a top 10, mm-hmm. and then I do kind of a just miss list. And
wow.
I do the same thing. One of the guys that I mentioned for fantasy purposes was Anfernee Seymour from the Marlins. Middle infielder with immense speed. Probably never makes it. You can't love the guy, but you look at it and say, wow, if he can just find a way to the majors, maybe he can be an impact. You know, maybe he can be Billy Hamilton in the middle infield, which Billy Hamilton was Billy Hamilton in the mid infield before he got moved to the outfield. That I agree. That's what I do as well. And we probably will never know. I just released Anfernee Seymour because I couldn't hold him onto my roster anymore. But he is a guy that I specifically remember fitting what you were just talking about.
Yeah, Anfernee is in. He's in the Marlins top 30. He is just outside the top 10 because he has tremendous speed. But you know, we're talking about he'll be in low class A this year, so he's way far away.
Yeah, and that's why I released him, is he doesn't have a lot of other tools, and he's a long way away, and the likelihood he makes the majors is pretty low. And so I said, okay, I have a roster crunch, and unfortunately, he's the one that I had to let go. But with your K to walk being such a big deal and the focus for fantasy, let me ask you about three quick players: Alex Reyes, Taylor Glasnow, Joey Gallo. Gigantic upside, gigantic tools. But interesting walk per K rate. What are your thoughts on those three guys fitting your description of what you're looking for from a fantasy prospect?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point. Those guys are all really good to look at, and I think I'll take Gallo. I like him as a prospect. But again, the team has to be willing to live. The thing I like about Gallo is this. He walks a lot. So he can – clearly he won't ever walk as much as he strikes out. I mean, he's – definitely in the, Matt Reynolds, who's the dude I'm thinking of, Chris, played for the Brewers last year, strikes out a ton. Not Chris Davis, the former Brewer, former Yankee, former Indian, Cardinals.
I think I know who you're talking
Diamondbacks.
About. Left-handed hitter?
No, right-handed hitter. Play for the Orioles, Diamondbacks, Yankees, Brewers, Indians. What the heck is that guy's name? He is a guy who will strike out 200 times in a season, given 600 at-bats. However, he can walk 100 times, and he will hit 40 home runs. I mean, Joey Gallo's power is unquestionably 80 on the 2080 scale. Also,
he may be 85. He may get 40 to create a new scale.
Exactly. He's super athletic. I remember talking to one of the Ranger scouts last year. We were at the Under Armour game, and he was there and talking to him about what the Rangers' plans were for Gallo, given that Beltre is still there and the guy they want to keep. And he said, you know, we played him at short. He didn't kill us. We played him in left field. He looked pretty good out there. So the fact that he has that kind of versatility, especially as a fantasy player, makes him super valuable. I mean, he is a guy who's going to hit 40 home runs probably at one point in his career, and he's going to strike out a ton, but he's also going to get on base. So I think Gallo, his ability to walk kind of offsets some of the issues with his strikeouts. So he's a guy that you make a pass for, in my opinion.
And Tyler Glasnow is a guy, great arm, obviously, big tall guy, long levers, kind of a bouncy delivery a little bit. I've always had concerns that he's not going to be able to consistently throw six or seven innings as far as command. I have a hard time. I've always thought that he would eventually be a reliever because of the delivery. But he's been working on that, and he throws like 109 miles an hour.
Right.
Are you a believer that Glasnow is going to be at the top of the rotation, or do you think he's a bullpen guy? Or because the fact that he's with the Pirates and their pitching coaches are phenomenal in getting guys to be able to be good. I mean, it's amazing. If you're bad,
yeah.
I mean, I think if they put me in their rotation, I could probably have an ERA under 3.6. I mean, they just do
right.
a phenomenal job with these guys who just were also Rams or probably never should have been. And all of a sudden, Jay Happ goes out and gets a contract. I completely give credit to what is it? Searsage is his name, and with the Pirates,
Ray, yeah.
Former, they just do a phenomenal
Met,
job.
Searsage,
can they turn him around, or is he going to be a reliever? I'm concerned a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's a good question, Chris. We talked about Glasnow yesterday, in fact, and you know, so Jim Benedict, who was the pitching guru for the Pirates, recently left, got hired by the Marlins. But they still have Ray Searsage, former Met great for those Mets fans listening. Ray Searsage has done phenomenal work on Pirates pitching. A.J. Burnett is a big factor there. Charlie Morton, another guy who went in there. They just picked up Jesse Biddle today, who's a guy who will definitely be thrown into the Ray Searsage machine and probably churn out a 3.20 ERA next year. But I think that the point with Glasnow is he just never gives up a hit. And so even if he's a guy who's walking, let's say, 4.1 per nine, if you're – so you got to look at the whip there in that case, right, Chris? So if you're pitching 200 innings, right, and you're giving up 150 hits like Glasnow does, and you walk 70, you know, you're kind of at a 1.2 whip, which is acceptable – is better than acceptable, which is very good. So that's the thing. If nobody hits the guy, you can sort of live with a higher walk rate. And it's the same thing with Reyes, another guy who's just dominant in terms of stuff. Ridiculous fastball. Good breaking stuff that's coming along. Doesn't have the issues that Glasnow has, which is, as you mentioned, the long levers and the difficulty holding base runners and things like that. So I put Reyes at a higher level to succeed, a higher probability to succeed because of that issue. Even with the marijuana suspension, he'll be fine. You know, it's 50 games. His development will be slowed a little bit, but not much.
Reyes, I do wonder about.
Mm-hmm.
The way that I kind of describe it is he has no idea where it's going, but the batters can't hit it anyway. The batters don't know it either. And his walk rate was – you don't see a lot of pitchers with as many strikeouts per inning as his, but also as many walks as his. Reyes was really at times, I mean, that wow is really the best way I can describe it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, his walk rate was a little high, I agree, but, you know, his stuff is just so good overall. And, you know, in talking to Texas League managers last year, I was told he was constantly, was the word this manager used, constantly at 100 miles an hour or better. I mean, that's ridiculous. Not consistently, not like, yeah, he did it three times a game, constantly. And he doesn't throw with max effort. I mean, you see his delivery, it's really smooth, comes over the top, great plane. He's, you know, I think if he can stay out of his own way, he's a monster. But, yeah, I mean, 0.6 respectively. But, you know, you look at the hit rate, and it's an acceptable whiff, 1.2 and 1.3. I'm sorry, 1.2 and 1.1.
Yeah, and that's one of
hits.
One of the points that I made last year when I was talking about him was, if you just looked at the numbers, the ERA and the WHIP, you say, wow, this guy, and the strikeouts, of course, you say, wow, this guy's amazing. You have to look inside the numbers to find a problem, which is, wow, the WHIP doesn't reflect how many walks he has. It's amazing how many
right.
people he walk, and yet the WHIP is so good.
Right. Yeah, I think a lot of people don't, you know, they look at one thing but not another, you know, the cause of that. There are things to look into sometimes beyond the obvious about. And I think that's the same thing with Newcomb, you know, the same thing. He didn't give up any hits. So you can maybe, you know, ameliorate the walk rate a little bit with that.
And probably the biggest pop-up prospect of 2015 might be Blake Snell. He's in the top 15
yes.
now, or top 20 anyway. Are you buying him? I'm always a little bit hesitant about guys who just come out of nowhere and have one monster year, and all of a sudden they're in the top 15 or top 20, but that happens every year. So are you a fully on board believer with this guy, and will he contribute to the majors in 2016?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, we So we're a little partial because he played in Durham this year, and he came to our office, and he did like a long, long form interview with John Manuel and J.J. Cooper. I mean, those guys talked for like 90 minutes, and you know, we're all always a little partial to guys who come into our office and hang out and stuff. And he's a really good dude. But you know, it goes beyond that. Obviously, he had a historic year in terms of ERA. I mean, you know, one of the best ERAs for a full season in the minors since, you know, Verlander was Verlander before he got to the majors. And so, yeah, I think a lot of it is the Rays are really good at pitching, you know, teaching pitching. And so I am a believer. I do think he'll contribute this year. You know, I don't know how much. The Rays have a good staff, but they also have injuries. But I do think he's more than just a trick pitch guy. You know, he's got some dominant stuff. I mean, he was our minor league player of the year, so we obviously love what he had. You know, we picked him in a very close race over A.J. Reed, so we obviously think a lot of him.
And who's going to be the 2016 Blake Snell? Who are those guys who right now maybe aren't even in the top 50, but all of a sudden they're going to pop up and be like, wow, and move significantly up ranking sports?
Yeah, I mean, I love Tyler J. I got to see Tyler pitch in Champaign last year at the regionals and super regionals. Guy came out of the bullpen, it was over. I mean, and he came out and pitched five innings. You know, he wasn't coming out and getting a hitter. He wasn't going out and getting three outs. And I know for sure there were a number of teams who were there looking at him for the number one pick last year. You know, teams that came in from all over just to watch him pitch. And when he came into the game, it was a different experience than facing. I mean, Kevin Duchesne got drafted by the A's, so he's no slouch. But when Kevin left the game and Tyler came in, it was a different story. I mean, guns came out, radar guns came out, gloves were popping. You know, it was that kind of thing. So I love Tyler J. I had one scout put a Cliff Lee comparison on him for me. And I believe that. I'm a big believer in Tyler J. So
any bats?
For me.
Go ahead. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, Ian Happ is a guy. No, Ian Happ of the Cubs. Cubs have had obviously tremendous success in college bats. Kyle Schwarber being the latest example of that. And Ian, you know, moved up a couple of classes last year because he was just so good. He might have been, and for a while he was the number one prospect to me in the Northwest League before Dansby, you know, righted himself there. Guy who makes real good contact with the bat, will have some over-the-fence power, will have some extra base power, could play second base, could play the outfield. I think he's probably more a guy who plays in the dirt, so probably a second baseman, but an impact guy at that. And he could move quickly because he's a college bat, and the Cubs are not afraid to move those guys quick.
Except for the fact that the Cubs are so crowded. Where do you find a spot for somebody?
It's a good point, Chris. You know, they traded Starlin Castro, but they still have tons of infield depth. I think they think of Javier Baez as more of a, you know, all-around utility guy. And so maybe, you know, maybe in a couple of years, Happ is a guy who plays second and left field as Zobrist's contract expires. And Zobrist got a four-year deal, so maybe not. But they'll find a place, you know, I think eventually for him somewhere in left or right or a utility guy. Joe Maddon loves guys like that. He fits that kind of mold for sure.
And to transition and finalize the entire program here, appreciate you putting in all the time. 2016 sure. In the majors, what prospects are going to make the biggest impact? And don't give me Buxton or Seager. Those are the obvious ones. But something other than the obvious, who are the guys who are going to actually make an impact in the majors and possibly an impact fantasy-wise as far as prospects go?
Yeah, I think you'll see A.J. Reed. I don't know if you count him as an obvious guy, but I think you'll see A.J. Reed in the majors this year, and a guy who can make a quick impact, tremendous left-handed bat, gets on base. You know, he's kind of a base clogger. He's not a speed guy, obviously, but just huge, huge left-handed power. I mean, as a guy who used to be a two-way guy at Kentucky, he was their Friday ace, and he's such a good hitter that the Astros didn't even think of him on the mound. He's a big boy. I mean, he's a, you know, might be a little too big for his own good, but superpower. Jose Berrios of the Twins, a guy who could make an impact on their rotation, which is a little in flux. Got to AAA last year, tremendous curveball, good changeup, good fastball. Puerto Rican pitcher who should be in the majors this year at some point. Glasnow, we mentioned. Tim Cooney is a guy who I'm very high on, probably the highest man in BA on him. Reminds me, he and Marco Gonzalez, again, of the Cardinals, are in the same boat in that they don't have top-of-the-scale stuff. They're probably fourth or fifth starters, guys who can bring you value in that spot. And Cooney pitched very, very well in a short amount of time with the Cardinals and isn't a good team to succeed. Other guys who could jump up like that, Hunter Renfroe, maybe in San Diego. They need outfield help. Played really well when he got to AAA. And Petco Park is a park that favors right-handed power hitters, pull hitters, especially guys like Renfroe, who I think could do well there. And Orlando Arcia, who we talked about earlier, too. I think VR is a placeholder now with Segura gone, and you could see Arcia there by July. They might hold on to him until the Futures game and then plug him in at that point. But he's a guy who will, you know, steal bases, hit for average, do those kinds of things.
Vince Lara from Baseball America talking with us, minor league prospects here on a podcast to be named later. If you want to follow him on Twitter, it's at Vince Lara. You can read him over at baseballamerica.com. Vince, thanks a lot for taking all the time today. Love talking prospects with you. Good job with all these names out here. Good comps, good information, and good inside sources as well. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. This was great.
All right, everybody. Again, that's Vince Lara talking minor league prospects with us today. We put in a lot of time. I should probably apologize for putting Vince all this time onto the program. But when you get good data, when you get good information, when you get good stories, it's just easy for me to get greedy and want to keep him on the program. So we kept him longer than we should have, and we appreciate him putting in all that extra time. These guys are very busy. They work very hard. So anytime they can put in this amount of time talking prospects with us, I got to be very appreciative for that. So thanks again to Vince Lara for coming on today. Again, I highly recommend you follow him on Twitter, at Vince Lara. I'm looking forward. I did not know that Baseball America was going to be on TV on the MLB Network. I can't wait to see that top list. They do a phenomenal job, obviously, over there. And I have to admit, I've done some writing for them. But they were doing fantastic work before they even knew who I was. So I'm not brown-nosing an organization that doesn't do great work. Baseball America is phenomenal at it, and I can't wait to see their stuff on MLB Network. So look and stay tuned for that. I'll let you know when they're doing that as well. But head on over to baseballamerica.com. If you don't get the handbook, I don't know what you're doing. You don't know prospects. You don't like prospects if you're not getting the Baseball America handbook every single year. As I said, mine just arrived. I have every single book going back probably 15 years now. If you haven't got it yet, go out and get it. And get it directly through the website over at baseballamerica.com. They give a supplemental version as well where they give you some additional prospects. And in fantasy, that matters. You know, you find guys – a lot of times – I found Francisco Liriano way back when I first started following prospects when he was with the Twins. He was ranked like 15th or 16th because he had Tommy John surgery and there was uncertainty about whether he could be a guy. The handbook goes all the way down to 30. You'll find those good fantasy guys at 16, 17, 18. And Baseball America does that detailed 30-person list along with the supplement. So head on over to the website. Get it directly through them rather than through Amazon or any of those other places. You get that additional information, and you can also sign up and be part of the website. Because, again, if you're not following Baseball America, then you really aren't getting a good look at what prospects are doing out there. They do phenomenal work over there. I don't know how they know all this stuff. They know how they find the time to do it. I mean, there are so many teams, so many organizations, so many people to talk to, so many prospects to look at, and they find a way to give you the information you need to know on all of them. So head on over to baseballamerica.com and get involved, because that's where the prospects is for you. But again, thanks everybody for tuning in today. Love talking prospects with Vince. This is a podcast to be named later. We're going to be talking Rays baseball later in the week. It looks like Lenny Melnick's going to come back onto the program. He's a speaker over at Sirius XM Radio. We're going to try to do our team MLB wraparound, wrap up the AL East. We've already done the Red Sox, the Yankees, the Orioles, and the Blue Jays. We're going to wrap up the Rays with Lenny on Friday. We've already done the Washington Nationals. We're going to be doing the Marlins with Vince Lara next week as well. So going from the AL East, which we're just finishing, we're going to do the NL East starting next week. and go through that and then transition over to, I'm not really sure where we're going to go next. There's so many teams to try to get to. It really depends on the guests that I'm going to be able to find. Jim Callis is eventually going to come on the program, hopefully to talk about one of those teams, but at the very least to talk prospects. Joe Sheehan is going to be coming on the program. He's going to talk about some teams in Major League Baseball. He's going to come in and do a couple of the teams. Joe Posnanski from SI.com, he's going to do a few teams with us. Rob Nyer said that he'd like to come on and do a team or two. So we've got some interesting people with some interesting insights when it comes to breaking down the 2016 chances for all of these different organizations. So stay tuned with me. Stay tuned on my Twitter account, at CJMitch73. If you want to talk with us on Facebook or be alerted to all of these different programs coming up, I post our events every single time that they're going to be appearing. And then that's a podcast to be named later on Facebook. They all eventually appear and get posted on minorleagueball.com, so you can go on over there. All of the podcasts that I've talked about in the AL East are already posted there. So if you want to listen to the one with Sean McAdam about the Red Sox, or you want to listen to Lenny Melnick, who talked about the Orioles, or George Kurtz, who's a New York guy who follows the Yankees, we did a podcast with him. And then the Blue Jays with Ben Nicholson-Smith. He covers the Jays for Sportsnet, I believe. Sportsnet.ca, I believe, is the website. That's listed on the website as well. But he did it with the Jays. He covers them specifically. We try to get guys who are covering the teams as much as possible. But if we can't, we bring on some general knowledge people like a Lenny Melnick. Those are all over at minorleagueball.com, as well as some of my other writings. I'm also posting prospect articles. If you want to talk about prospects when it comes to fantasy relevance, I write during the season for Baseball America, or at least I did last year, and I do that during the winter over at rotoexperts.com, as well as during the season. So if you want to follow prospects and look at them from a fantasy perspective, head on over to rotoexperts.com. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Love talking baseball with you. Again, Friday, we're going to be talking Tampa Bay Rays with Lenny Melnick. And then next Wednesday, we'll be talking about the Florida Marlins again with Vince Lara from BaseballAmerica.com. So tune in for that as well. Thanks, everybody. Be safe, be good, and continue to follow baseball.